Any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up?
Can you just briefly explain the two sides of coins again?
Two sides of a coin, okay. We had right at the beginning there this statement that things are empty of inherent existence, meaning they're not independently existent, because they are dependent arisings, because they're dependently existent. So when we look at how things exist, we examine, we come to see that we can't find the object in the basis, that there's no findable object there, meaning it's empty of independent existence. The object merely exists within our conceptual framework. So that's sort of the two ways of looking at the same thing, that there is no independent object there at the same time because it only exists within our conceptual framework. So we're talking about the same thing. The one is talking about how that exists through negating how it doesn't exist, it's not independent, and the other one is an affirmative statement that it's a dependent arising. So we're talking about the very same object. So they're two sides of a coin. They're talking about the very same thing from two different perspectives. One saying it's not independent, and the other is saying it's dependent. So it's talking about the same thing, of course not identical, because it's two different perspectives. So that's what we mean by two sides of a coin. So we're not talking about the fact that ultimate truth is some sort of other reality, you know, that we're in this reality and we're trying to discover some alternate reality. No. We're trying to discover how this very world exists. That's ultimate truth. So two truths are not two different realities. It's simply understanding the one reality that's in front of us.
Our question was regarding the relationship between human beings.
Between human beings, yeah.
Let's say you're having a problem, like someone treated you really badly, and you're my friend, and you come to me. So on the one hand, if I tell you, oh, that's a really bad experience, that person is so not nice, or whatever, so I'm giving you support, but I'm only strengthening your concept or the wrong way of seeing things as existing on their own. But on the other hand, if I tell you, I hear how you feel, I hear you're having trouble, just acknowledging your feelings and not fixing it, maybe you won't get the support you need from me.
So, at the conventional level, we need to deal with situations. And, of course, at the conventional level now, according to this view at least, we're all grasping to independent me, independent world. Even when we do something good, we're grasping onto me doing this independently good action. So, in the short term, at the conventional level, then we are simply what we are trying to overcome. We can talk about two levels of ignorance here. One of the deepest level of ignorance is misunderstanding reality. So that's we need to overcome. That's the long-term goal, to overcome that. But there's another level of ignorance, is ignorance within respect the law of cause and effect in terms of our behavior. That's something we can deal with immediately, that we can overcome this ignorance in terms of avoiding harmful behaviour, engaging in virtuous behaviour. So in the short term, at least, we will not create the causes for future suffering. Therefore, that will enable us to find good conditions so that we can work on overcoming the deeper level of ignorance in the long term. So therefore, if someone has a problem or difficulty, then there's no point, I mean, if it's just someone that's not into this sort of philosophy, no point going to saying, well, you know, your suffering doesn't inherently exist. I mean, that's just no point, is it? Then you go at a conventional level and you give them advice and help about how to overcome that. So that's the short-term strategy to help them immediately overcome their difficulties. But from a Buddhist perspective, we're still going to be stuck in this cycle. So we need to begin there, and then we need to go to the next level of overcoming the fundamental ignorance. So we need to work on both. And of course, who we work with depends on what advice is helpful for them. Anything else anyone would like? Yeah.
Interconnectedness for me is very easy to understand in terms of physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you kind of stop drawing lines around everything, everything sure. is just some sort of constantly changing flow of matter.
Sure.
It's harder for me to apply that to consciousness.
Yes.
I was wondering how that works. Both in terms of should I feel a sense of oneness with this building or pillar or rock? And also, how does really that relate? Because I don't see how my mind is the same in any sense as your mind or as anyone else's here.
Yeah. I think at a very simple level, of course, we can, if we look at our mind, we can see how the functioning of our mind is really causes and conditions. You know, that if we really, sometimes it seems like thoughts and emotions just come out of nowhere, no cause. But actually, if we look closely, we'll come to better appreciate how our mind is functioning or dysfunctional, and it's all through causes and conditions. And we really start to very clearly see this interdependency at that level in terms of how our mind is functioning, perceiving, reacting. It becomes very obvious the interplay of causes and conditions. So that's the first step. And then, of course, the next step would be then to work on this view of emptiness in terms of coming to appreciate that there is no actual independent world out there, that the world is a product of our mind. And then we can really appreciate the interplay between our mind and the world. And on that point, actually, is something I wanted to clarify, but now I can based on your question, is that also within Buddhism, of course, there's, like in philosophy, quantum physics, all these fields, there's no uniform consensus. There are different theories competing. Also in Buddhism, here, there are a number of competing theories. There's no uniform acceptance. Because remember, the Buddha taught according to people's capacities. So he taught different things. And through that, what we have is in ancient India, we have four philosophical systems evolving, which I want to briefly mention. And the two first philosophical systems, called Vaibhashika Sautrantika, and I use the Sanskrit words here, is in this philosophical system, there is an objective independent world. And that objective world is made up of atoms and subatomic particles. So in this level of teaching, the Buddha taught basically atomic theory. That the world is made up of very small, indivisible particles. And that exists objectively. In this system, these philosophical systems, what the problem is not how we see the world. There is a world there, objective. There is a cup there, existing from its own side, independent of me. The problem is how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me, we grasp onto this self. So these two systems, I think, sort of equivalent to some modern philosophy, it would be their metaphysical realists. There is an objective world made up of atoms, no problem there. Another philosophical system that developed called Chittamatra. Chittamatra, sometimes translated in English, is mind only. And the Chittamatra philosophical system completely refutes this idea to the point where Chittamatra says there is no physical reality at all. It's an illusion. There appears to be physical matter and energy, but this is an illusion. And they use the analogy of a dream. That in a dream, if we're not lucid, we go up to objects in the dream and go, yes, that's very solid. It's made of matter, it's made of energy in the dream. It's only when we're lucid do we realize that this appearance is deceiving us. So they use this analogy to sort of highlight what their view is. That yes, there appears to be a solid material world out there, but this is an illusion. That everything is of the nature of the mind. And I think this is equivalent to, anyone who's a philosopher, idealism. Is that right? Sorry?
Subjective idealism.
Subjective idealism. There we go. I think there's a number of different forms of idealism, isn't there? Vaguely, I know that. So this is Chittamatra. Then the system we're talking about today is Majjhimaka. This is often translated as middle way. So in the Majjhimaka philosophical system, which is the one we're looking at now, there is an external world made of matter and energy, but it's not independent of the mind.
Can you say that again?
In the Majjhimaka philosophical system, there is an external material world, but it's not independent of the mind. I don't know what the term here is for philosophical system. Anyone hazard a guess? Anyone who's a philosopher? I think once I heard something like, what was it? Ontological relativism. Someone mentioned that, but I don't know. Anyway, this is the system that we are looking at now. So I just wanted to briefly mention that even in Buddhism, there is a lot of discussion and about how, what is the nature of reality. There's no uniform consensus, as in philosophy, as in quantum physics, as in classical physics, probably.
Can you explain second one again, please?
Second, this one. Well, Satyajit and Vaibhashika are the same. They have some slight differences, but in terms of how reality exists, they have the same view. They both are accepting that there is an objective world made up of matter and energy, independent of the observer.
Less about beings, but like
sure.
A lot of the explanations that we're getting are mostly about, like, I feel like they relate more to the relationship of like a single consciousness with the world around it. And I'm wondering how the concept of multiple consciousnesses works.
Yeah. And
how that's explained.
What we can understand when we start to understand this idea, particularly the idea of this idea of interdependency or dependency. Many of us, of course, have some belief in interdependency at some level because we see it in operation. Climate change, all of these things are examples of interdependency. So we all have some acceptance of interdependency at some level. But here, in this view, what we're talking about is that, you know, when we're talking about interdependency between two things, You know, often now we think that that means there are two things that are connected. But this view is saying the connection defines the endpoints. These only exist because of connection. There's not two things that are connected. Like big and small. Big and small are not somehow connected. Size creates big and small. So this is sort of how we are to understand a little bit my consciousness versus your consciousness. My consciousness and your consciousness are not the same, and they're not different. Because different means two things that are somehow connected. Is that your question?
Yes, but it's just much easier to understand in terms of physicality, and I was maybe wondering if you could clarify more, like, how all of our consciousnesses are the same.
Well, they're not the same, and they're not different.
Not the same, but how they're part of the same flux of mind stream, let's call it.
Yeah. What this view, and particularly this view, is not saying, and sometimes when people look at this view, that, you know, everything's just a creation of my mind, everything's internal to my mind, this view is not solipsism. Meaning, it's not like my mind is the only real thing in the universe, and everything else, including other people, are just a figment of my imagination. Okay. This is not the Chinnamatra view, and not the Madhyamika view. I don't know. Anyway, Chittamatra view is not that the only real thing in the universe is my mind and that everything else is illusory, including minds and other people. They're just illusory. This is not the view of Chittamatra.
So
it's not solipsism.
It's not like there is no physicality.
For them, there is no physicality.
There's no physicality, but there's more than one consciousness.
Yes, but those consciousnesses are not different. Well, at least in the Madhyamika. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Because this is a huge topic.
Yes,
okay.
I have a question about this. We were talking about question two.
Yep.
And we found it much easier to see how the experience of emptiness would be useful with an irritating person.
Sure.
Versus the topic.
The short answer is beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right, so we totally said, well, the inherent enjoyment in the chocolate cake is only in our own minds, but that's not that useful.
It's not?
We found it more useful to think about an irritating person and to be able to remember that that person is irritating, it, not inherently, but...
Yeah, of course, because irritating person example may lead to some very harmful behaviour, whereas eating chocolate cake probably won't. What we need to realise here, of course, is, and this goes back to what we talked a little bit about before lunch, these three stages, go, nyam, tok, the intellectual, taste and realisation, is that if we leave it at the intellectual level, even if we have a very clear understanding about the Buddhist view of reality, and then we meet an irritating person at work, we're probably just going to react. And then afterwards we think, oh, actually I shouldn't have reacted because they're not inherently irritating, are they? But then it's too late. Whereas if we meditate and we have a taste of emptiness, and that's still affecting our mind, when we meet the irritating person, we won't need to intellectually go, oh, they're not inherently irritating. It will just be automatic. It will be instinctual to see that. And then we won't react. I mean, we'll respond, probably with compassion, but we won't react. So the key here with this is to move it from intellectual to experiential. Otherwise, it's always going to be a struggle. Of course, if we're very mindful in the day, and we intellectually appreciate this, we could keep reminding ourselves, and then maybe a little bit we'll stop reacting, but it's going to be a struggle to continue to remind ourselves of these things. So therefore, if we can bring it into experience, then it will become more instinctive rather than we have to think about it. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Madhyamika. Or Madhyamika, or depending on how you pronounce Sanskrit. That one, middle way. Middle way school.
So that's the basis of Mahayana thinking,
right? In here, Chittamatra, they also talk about emptiness. They also talk about non-duality, but it has a different meaning. Here, in Chittamatra, non-duality means no subject-object duality, means no external world whatsoever, internal to the mind. Non-duality here means no independent me and world. This means no external me and no external world.
Okay.
And so they talk about emptiness, but it means a bit different.
So Mahayana believes number four.
In Tibetan, the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the system that they follow is this, Madhyamika.
Okay.
Sometimes Chittamatra view is useful to use. Because if we appreciate the Chittamatra view, again, it would be very difficult to develop attachment to anything, because there's nothing external. It's all part of my mind. So why would you develop a craving and attachment to those flowers, which are actually the nature of your own mind? So this view, even though from a Madhyamic perspective is not 100% correct, can be useful in a practical sense. I mean, if you can adopt this view, you will find that a lot of things like craving and attachment will become difficult to, because there's nothing external to my mind.
Okay. So Theravada doesn't believe in any of these five philosophical schools?
These two systems, these two philosophical systems, particularly this one, is the basis of many Theravada traditions. So what we need to realize is these are philosophical systems that may be the basis of various Buddhist schools. But then, of course, when we go into meditate, what we realize may be something very different. So even though your philosophical school, your tradition may be talking this, when you sit down to meditate, doesn't mean you can't realize this. In fact, the Madhyamikas would say that's actually what's going to eventually happen. That even if you start meditating with this view, you will come to realize eventually the deepest view. This is like a stepping stone.
Okay, so my next question. I don't know where my view is falling. when I meditate, I have a hard time accepting this emptiness theory, just because I don't feel the word emptiness is very appropriate.
It's actually very literal on the original Sanskrit word, so it's a very good translation.
Okay, so then that makes me think that my understanding is not
correct. Right.
So my understanding is that we are not empty, everything is not empty, that actually we are all encompassing.
That's the same meaning. Remember I said emptiness means fullness, fullness means emptiness. So let me go to the original word, shunyata. Shunya actually means hollow or zero. The Indians invented the number zero in, I think, the 6th century or something. And zero, and shunya means hollow, means sort of no essence. There's nothing, you know, it's hollow in that sense. So what that means is when we say emptiness, we need to understand empty of what? What is it lacking? What is lacking is independent existence. So that's how we have to understand emptiness. What's hollow or what's missing or what's not there
is its own unique nature, existing from its own side, independent existence. So that's how we have to understand shunyata, or emptiness.
I don't like this word, emptiness. it just means, to me, empty means nothing is there.
But that's why...
I think everything is there.
And that's why everything is there. Because when we see emptiness, we have to say, empty of what? If I say to you, something is empty, physical thing, you'll say, empty of what? Empty of water, or empty of air, empty of what? Wouldn't you? Same here. And when you say empty, you say, empty of what? And I say, everything's empty of being independent. And so this is the understanding of shunyata, or emptiness. And because it's empty of independent existence, it's full of dependent existence. Everything's interdependent. In that sense, emptiness is fullness, fullness is emptiness.
So that if I believe that everything is all-encompassing, interconnected, what's my view?
Well, if you come to realize that, this is this view. But again, we can have the idea intellectually of interconnectedness with this idea. There's two things that somehow are always connected. This is not this view. Like I said, it's perspective that defines the entity. It's the perspective of size that creates big and small. You don't have big and small that are somehow connected, do we? So in that sense, that's interdependency.
You say that you have to practice to meditate in order to realize or to have at least an experience of emptiness?
No. You can have a taste in nature. You can have a taste in daily life. Often, and many people have this, and you can have a taste by some drug, some stimulus. So what I'm suggesting is that you can have a strong stimulus through drug, nature, that can create very briefly a little taste, but it will go quickly.
Because what my point is that there is studies about
what?
Study with meditants, and they, you know, with these electrodes and other things, and they show that at a high level of meditation, what's happened is that the brain area, which is responsible for the perception of the self, of the space and of the time, are just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's quite strange because it's as if this perception of emptiness or of was just actually a kind of, you know, just the brain is...
like control of the mind.
That it's because of the brain that we can feel the emptiness. So it's because of this reality that... You see what is, at least for me, a kind of...
And of course, if we accept that matter is primary, we will have that view.
Yeah.
So the question is, and this is what these two views challenge, is matter is not primary. If we hold on to matter as primary, we will always come up with this view.
But they can prove...
No, they can't.
They can prove, but they can show that the feeling of emptiness is a consequence of...
No.
Less matter and...
No. What they can show is there's a correlation between the experience of emptiness and a certain brain activity. They can show that, and that's all they can show. Then they jump to a conclusion that one is causing the other. But this is a leap of faith, isn't it? And they do that because they believe matter is primary. That's why they come to this conclusion. But if we were really being a scientist, all we could prove is that this experience correlates with a certain brain activity. That we can prove.
And don't you make the same kind of error when you say that mind and consciousness is primary?
Again, this is the theory. We test it. We test it. Again, just because Buddhism says this, don't blindly believe it. It's not going to help you. We need to check it and test it.
But does it say that mind is primary, isn't it? Doesn't it say that they both exist once?
But mind is primary, as in mind is creating reality.
Isn't that the third one?
No. We're not saying that because the mind creates reality here, therefore the things we create are mental phenomena. We're not saying that at all. Here. Here, yes. We're not saying that.
Mind creates reality and then becomes.
Becomes.
I mean, mind creates reality, material reality? That's what it says.
Again, to use these sort of words can be misleading if you don't understand what we're talking about there. So, here, of course, reality is just mental. There is no such thing as physical world. It's an illusion. Here there is a physical world, but it's not independent of the observer. That's all. Anyway, we need to move on. So last quick question.
I understand that we conceptualize or the concept of a bowl or a table.
Sure.
But do we do the same thing for another consciousness, like animals or people?
That's my next point, so I'll come there now. Okay.
As I mentioned this morning, when we look out on the world, to make sense or meaning out of all of this, we have to draw lines and create objects, meaningful objects, and then give them names so we can communicate. And we need to do this, otherwise we couldn't. There'd be no meaning, we couldn't function. Generally, in our experiences, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here. Because there's single experience, and in single experience, we can conceptually distinguish experiencer from experienced, and we need to do that. But there's no independent experiencer. There's single experience, and within that, we have these two aspects. So we tend to draw a line around here, create the experiencer, and give it a label, me, observer, whatever label. And then the experienced, or subject, object, me, world, whatever labels we want to apply. We need to do this, otherwise we couldn't function. But again, the problem is, we don't realize that's what we're doing. We turn the line into a boundary, and we see ourselves as already independent of experience. The experiencer being independent of experience. And this grasping onto the experiencer part is called self-grasping. Grasping onto independent me. And we saw how that leads to mental afflictions and suffering. But to really understand how that self-grasping is completely illogical, again, we can use this example, is this big? You can't have big on its own. You can only have big relative to small. Like you can only have up relative to down, in to out. Like that, you can only have me relative to not me. The not me can be you, the world. But you can only have experiencer relative to experience. You can only have subject relative to object. So when we grasp on to me, independent me, that's exactly like saying this is big. It's completely illogical. Now, this is what we do. So what we're doing is we're contracting around the me part of the experience. We're seeing ourselves as independent of the experience, of the experienced. And so we are completely out of sync with reality. We are fighting against reality because the reality is interdependent. Experiencer, experiencer, interdependent. But if we see ourselves as independent of the experienced, we fight against reality. And so when we fight against reality, we're out of sync with reality, we have mental afflictions, we suffer. Now, generally, in most of our actions, we have quite strong self-grasping. Me, 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 me. Generally, our perspective is me going there, me saying this, me doing that, with this self-grasping. But sometimes in our actions, the self-grasping is not so strong. And that often happens when we're more focused on the activity rather than the agent, rather than the me. And we know from our own experience, when that happens, things seem to go a lot better. For example, when we are absorbed in a program on TV, we are absorbed in reading a good book, we're absorbed in fixing a problem at work. In those occasions, we're more focused on the activity than the agent. And we know from our own experience in those cases, time seems to go quite quickly, things seem to flow quite well. Why? Because we're not fighting so much against reality. And this is very much highlighted in people who have developed high level of focus. For example, professional athletes, professional musicians have spent thousands of hours training in their activity. So much so that when they're doing the activity, they often report they're in the zone or the flow state. What's happening there, of course, is they're so highly focused on the activity, the self-grasping is very much reduced. And so much so that they often report there's no sense of me. There was just the music playing, just the sporting activity happening. And also they report peak performance, optimum performance. Why? Because they're not fighting against reality by self-grasping. But this, of course, is only through concentration. That through concentration, temporarily, the self-grasping is reduced. What we're talking about here, of course, is eliminating self-grasping through the Vipassana practice, realizing there, in fact, is no independent experiencer. And if we can realize emptiness, we can realize there is no boundary here between us and the experience. There's not one single boundary in the entire universe. And if we can realize that, then spontaneously, we will express that as boundless love and compassion for everyone. So, therefore, it's very much recommended that when we begin this investigation into reality, that we start by focusing on ourselves as a person. Because we can investigate anything. We can look at the cup, the laptop, the body, anything. But it's very much recommended to look at me, the person. How do I exist? Because this is where we start to go wrong. We grasp onto independent me, and then, of course, by default, we're grasping onto independent world. So if we can look for the me to overcome the self-grasping, we can realize this emptiness. So what I'd like to do now is have a look at one method, and there are many approaches, of how to investigate me, the person. How do I exist? And this is the method that you'll be using with Renato this afternoon, doing a little emptiness practice looking at the person. So I thought it'd be good to lay out the approach so that you have that clear in your mind when you do the practice this afternoon. But before I do that, any questions? Right, but initially, yes, because you have to be able to improve. But I think at some point, it becomes spontaneous and you don't have a sense of self anymore. There's just the activity happening, isn't there? Yeah.
But the reason, in the event that I'm practicing, is to develop myself.
Correct. So, we're talking about here, so we're not talking about the fact that you don't exist. We're talking about perceiving yourself and the activity in the correct way. And now we have, I have to practice because I have to get better and I. And actually, the more that we have that self-grasping, you're probably going to find that in your practice you're going to get more frustrated, less because you're not progressing as well as you want, and so forth. So even as a beginner, this I with self-grasping, you'll find that interferes. So even as a beginner, if we can let go of that self-grasping and just focus on the activity, you probably find as a beginner that things will go better. But then, of course, as we go deeper into the practice, whatever we're practicing, instrument, and we get more and more focused on the activity, and the activity, we don't have to think about what we need to do. So the conceptual mind shuts down because we're not having to remind ourselves we need to do this, then this. Exactly. And so then you'll find that when you're practicing, because you don't have to think about what you're doing, you're just doing it, and you're so focused on that, the sense, the focus on me, the agent doing it, will drop away. And then you really just have that experience of there's no real sense of me, there's just the music is playing. But again, this is only through concentration. So temporarily, the self-grasping is reduced. What we're talking about here is not just reducing temporarily, we're talking about eliminating. Okay.
So when you're enlightened, you lose your sense of I?
When you're enlightened, you lose your false sense of I. You don't have any more self-grasping. Do you have a sense of me, the person? Absolutely. But that sense of person is a sense of a dependent me, merely labelled me. It's not like when we become enlightened, we all melt into one big blob or something. No.
But you don't see yourself. You don't see your...
You have a sense of me,
and
that me is an interdependent me.
So you don't have the same concern for yourself? Or do you
concern.
I mean, you have equal concern. Like right now, I think most people tend to look after themselves first and then look out for other people second.
Yeah, you would never do that. You would never have that. Even well before enlightenment, I think you wouldn't have that. Okay. So this is one of many approaches in Vipassana practice here to realize there's no independent me. But this is the one that you'll be, I think, following a little bit with Renata this afternoon. And it's called the four essential points. There are four steps to this practice. The first, and this is the most important point in this whole steps, and I'll use the terminology that you see, there's a very good book on this, how to explain this, from the Dalai Lama, called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. And I'm using his terminology because it's a little bit easier. The first point is what's called identifying the target. What this means is that now we grasp on to independent me. And what we're doing in this meditation is we're going to see, do I in fact exist independently? So if we're going to search for the independent me, we need to know what this independent me looks like. The example is, or the analogy is, if I wanted to look for a particular person in a crowded room, first, to determine whether they're there or not, first I need a clear picture of the person. If I don't have a clear picture of what that person looks like, I can look forever and not be sure is that person in the room or not. Similarly here, if we're going to look for the independent me, we need to have a clear picture of what this independent me looks like. Because that's what we're going to look for in this meditation. So this is called identifying the target. The technical term here is identifying the object of negation.
Now, often when we sit down to meditate, of course, and we relax the body, quiet the mind, then often there's not really a strong sense of me anymore. So then it's, as a beginner, it could be a bit difficult to notice how does this independent me look like. So often in this meditation, in the beginning phase, what's often suggested in the meditation text is think of some situation where you have a strong sense of me. And the examples they give are things like, imagine someone is accusing you of something you never did, imagine someone's praising you. Generally in those situations, we have a strong sense of me. How dare you accuse me of that? Yes, I'm very good, aren't I? So we have a strong sense of me. And that is this me that we identify with. That's the me we need to look for. And this is the most common point where people go astray in this practice. In that, when they do the search, they always come up with an answer. But they're turning it into an intellectual exercise. Because generally most of us who've done a bit of reading and studied a bit of philosophy, often we've come up with an idea of who we think we are. You know, if we've studied a bit of Buddhism, you know, then often we go, I'm the subtle mental continuum. Or if we've studied a bit more modern things, I'm subtle energy. You know, I'm just subtle energy. And so then when we do the meditation at the end, they go, well, I'm just subtle mental continuum. I'm just subtle energy. I'm just aura. That's me. But then we've completely missed the point. Because when someone is accusing us and we're reacting, are we identifying with subtle mental continuum or subtle energy? I don't think so. I don't think so. So what we need to do is be looking for the me that we identify with experientially, not some vague intellectual idea of who we think we are. It's the same as if we're looking for a person in a room. All we need to do is have a clear picture of what that person looks like and then look directly. We don't turn that into an intellectual exercise, do we? We just clear picture and then look. Same here. Don't turn it into an intellectual exercise because you will always come up with an answer based on your understanding. Again, just get a clear sense of this independent me here that's being threatened or being praised. And then look directly for that me. So this is the first point.
Do you have a question?
Sure.
The me that I'm looking for depends on how other people see me. So
no.
Can you say that I need to find myself as the way people praise me or blame me?
What I'm saying is, though, that those situations provoke a strong sense of me when someone's criticizing or praising. So we have a strong sense of me. That's the me we're relating to. That's the me we need to look for. Yeah. You have a sense of me. I'm being blamed. So that's the me we are identifying with when someone's blaming us. When someone's blaming us, we're not seeing ourselves as subtle energy or subtle mental continuum or some sort of aura, are we? No. No. So we don't need to bother about that because that's not... If we were relating to ourselves as some subtle mental continuum or subtle energy, we'd probably never react, but we don't. So we have a strong sense of me. That's the me we need to look for.
We need to look for it because we need to...
Because that's the me that is the basis of our behaviour, and that's the me then we get angry, or we get arrogant, or we get jealous, or we... You know, it's the basis of all of our mental afflictions.
So we can find it?
See if it exists. We need to see if it exists, because that's the one we believe in. We're looking to see, does that need exist? Because we believe in it.
But what is inspiring your action?
Hmm?
Like, because it seems to me like the what you're looking for is that thing. Because what they're praising and what they're blaming is an action.
No. They're praising you. They're blaming you.
They're looking at an action.
It doesn't matter what they're looking at. It's how you are looking. It doesn't matter whether they're correctly or incorrectly blaming you. That's irrelevant. What we're talking about is how we're seeing ourselves. You know, how other people see us is irrelevant to us in terms of how we exist. What we're trying to work out is how do we exist? And now we grasp onto the fact that there's an independent me here. So the question is, well, is there an independent me here? Let's look for that. Let's see if there is an independent me here. But if we're going to look for the independent me, just like we're going to look for a particular person in a room, we have to have a clear picture of that. Otherwise, we'll do the search and we'll come up, well, maybe yes, maybe no. We won't know.
But what's the force that's making, choosing to do, virtuous or non-virtuous?
It's irrelevant here. We're not talking about then what we do as a result. We're just talking about how we see ourselves as a person. That's all. And we see ourselves as a person pretty well all the time as an independent me. And then we need to look for that. Do we in fact exist independently? And so the second point here is limiting the possibilities, which is understanding where we need to look. Because if there is an independent me, it must be findable. Which means it can only be in one of two places. Either that independent me is the same as the body and the mind, or it's different than the body and the mind. That's the second step, just understanding that. That if it's an independent me exists, it's got to be findable, and it can only be in one of two places. Either it's the same as the body and the mind, or different than the body and the mind. So that's limiting the possibilities, knowing where to search, to be comprehensive. Question?
Just to identify the target, are you just visualising a situation, or is it a feeling in the body? Like when you're talking, I'm thinking of a situation in which I was offended, and so immediately I'm then scanning the body and I can have a sense of feeling the solidifying sense of
No. Because when we have it's just a sense of me, and of course when someone's threatening us, together with that we'll have lots of things going on in the body. You know, if it's a negative, someone's criticizing, we'll have I'm being criticized, and together with that we'll have some sort of contraction in the body. But that's just a contraction. That's the me's having the contraction, but that's not me. So it's just the sense of me, that's all. We're not looking for anything sort of...
But am I visualising me?
Well, you're just
getting to the...
All we're doing in this first part is just sitting in the experience of me. And just making that clear, that's all. Remember, we haven't started looking here yet, so we're not looking yet. We're just resting in the experience of me. And just familiarising ourselves with that me, that sense of me. So we're not looking, oh, I'm experiencing it here in the body, and that's searching later. So it's just me, and just hold that experience of me. And just rest in that, that's all. Then we do the search. So if the me is independent, it must be findable, it must either be the same as the body and the mind, or different. So the third and fourth point is that search in those two places. You can do that in either order, but most often you do same first. See if it's the same. The body and the mind. So here, then, you would look in the body and you look in the mind and see if you could find the me. Then if you don't find it there, then the only other place it could be is different than the body and the mind, which would mean you'd have to be able to take away the body, take away the mind, and be left with the me. So you could do it in that way here. You could just simply take away the body, take away the mind, and see if there's a me left over. I mean, even intellectually, this really doesn't make any sense. But to be complete, you need to do that. So the only sensible place it could possibly be is here. But to be complete, it's good to do that as well. And then if we do this search, and at some point we're doing the search and then it becomes obvious it's not findable anywhere, then we hold that experience. The experience of not finding is an experience of emptiness. So we hold that experience as long as we can. And often what happens, of course, is within a few seconds we start thinking about dinner and what everyone else is doing in the class and what I'm going to do after the course and so forth. And then, of course, the suggestion is, if that happens, go back and look again. And if you don't find, again, hold. Now, as I've already, I think, mentioned once or twice, one of the most common experiences in this meditation as a beginner is fear. Fear coming up. And generally, if fear comes up, it's a very good sign. It means we are doing the search correctly and we are coming to the correct conclusion. There's no findable me, no independent me. But what we're doing is we're misinterpreting that experience. We're misinterpreting the not finding to mean there's no me at all. So again, the correct interpretation is there's no findable me, no independent me. So if you're having fear coming up, to overcome that immediately, you could simply fear that we're going out of existence or we don't really exist. Ask the question, who's having the fear? If there's no me, there can be no fear. So you're not going out of existence. So if we, again, as we looked at this morning, if we can appreciate that there is a middle way between the two extremes of independent existence and nihilism, there is a dependent me, then when we come to the point of not finding, instead of fear arising in our mind, joy will arise in our mind. Because we will realize the independent me that I've identified within my entire life, that's the root of all of my mental afflictions and suffering, simply does not exist. Yippee. It's actually crazy that a non-existent is the root of all of our suffering. Something that does not exist is the cause of all of our suffering. It's simply because we believe in it, we suffer. And it doesn't exist. It's crazy. So, again, we hold that experience as long as we can. And this is the practice that you'll be more or less doing with Renato this afternoon. Of course, there are many approaches to doing this sort of emptiness practice in some other traditions, and maybe I'll introduce a little bit of a meditation on this in one of the two meditation days. In two of the Tibetan traditions, the Kagyu Nyingma tradition, when they do this sort of Vipassana practice, they tend to more focus on the mind and look for the mind. Because one thing that can happen understanding these sorts of things, we can sort of appreciate, well, everything's sort of a product of the mind, therefore the mind must be real. Everything else is an illusion, but the mind is real. But then we can look for the mind. Where's the mind? And I might introduce a little Vipassana practice on that in the meditation days. Look for our own mind. See if we can find our mind. Very interesting practice. I like it a lot. So I think I'll bring one in into the meditation day. Question?
about this. Yeah. So, again, ego is a word, and I think even in psychology there are probably a number of different definitions of what that means. So I think even in psychology there's discussion about what ego is and is not. I don't like to use it here because, again, if I use the word, maybe six different ideas about what I'm talking about. But if we want to equate ego with self-grasping, then from a Buddhist perspective, we need to completely eliminate ego in that sense. But again, it would completely depend on how you define that term. And I think in general, in psychology, not that I understand much about it, but it seems to me that the main job of psychology is to make an unhealthy ego healthy. And I think the job of Buddhism is to transcend the healthy ego, more or less, if we keep it simple. That's sort of my understanding.
Can we go again to the number three? Like, how do the search between...
Yeah. And Renato will be guiding you this afternoon, but it can be a little bit... it can be quite detailed or very simple. So I'm not exactly sure how detailed Renata will be, but like, for example, if the me is the same as the body and the mind, you must be able to find it here somewhere. So then you can, for example, start by looking in the body. Is there a me somewhere in the body? And then we can sort of systematically go through the body. We can sort of start at the head, move down, chest, here. So we can sort of step through and see, is there the me anywhere there? And then if we don't find it, we can go, okay, let's look in the mind. And then we can look in the mind, and then we can also systematically go through the mind. We can say, like, okay, is the me any of the thoughts, emotions, any of that me, memories, any of these things me? And then you can also say, well, is the mind me as well? You can look at the mind itself. Is that me? And so if you go through that systematically and you don't find it anywhere there, then it's not the same as the body and the mind. And then if it's not different, then there's no findable me.
So it's not intellectual, like saying, I can understand that if I don't have a hand, I am still me?
This process here is not intellectual. If we turn it into an intellectual exercise, we've missed the point. What we're doing is we're looking directly. Like the example of looking for a person in a room, first we have to have a clear picture of what they look like, and then we just look directly, with direct observation, if any of those people match this description. Similarly, we're looking in our body and our mind, looking for anything that matches the description of the I. No. Dependent me, exactly, that's exactly the point, is findable me equals independent me. So actually, that brings me on to the next point. If there's no findable me, how do I exist? There is a me. How does the me exist if there's no findable independent me? So let's have a look at that now. And that's exactly like we looked at before. Actually, we can use the pen. We used the pen before. We said this morning, the pen is not the collection of the parts. The pen is labelled depending on the collection of the parts. So there's no pen to be found here in the basis. It's not findable. Because the only pen that exists is the one that exists in our conceptual framework. The one that's labelled on that basis. Similarly, the person. The person is not the body and the mind. Like the pen is not the collection of the parts.
The person is labeled depending on the body and the mind. There's no findable me here, because me only exists within the conceptual framework, and it's labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. Now, related to that, and I promised to sort of answer this question earlier, so I better answer it now, is what goes from life to life? What's the Buddhist assertion? And as I mentioned earlier, the way the question is asked is a bit awkward, because when you ask what goes from life to life, at least how I see it, the word go implies some entity that is moving from this life to the next. In that sense, the answer is nothing goes from life to life, just like nothing goes through in the physical world through time. There's just a flow of change in the physical world. Similarly, the mental world, similarly, the person. So let's have a look at what I mean. Let's assume this is my life. Body and mind. Both the body and mind, the body, of course, is a flow of physical change. The mind is a flow of mental experience. Let's say this is the present moment. The me that exists right now is the me labeled on the mind that is existing now and the body that exists now. So the me that exists right now is, again, the shorthand term is the mere I. The I that is merely labelled on the body and the mind. That's the me, the dependent me. The me labelled, depending on the body and the mind, the me labelled on the body and the mind that is existing right now. That's the me that exists now. So at every point in our life, the me that exists is the me that is labelled on the basis of the body and the mind that exists in that moment. Now, when we get to the point of death, as we saw earlier, the death process, in the first four stages, the coarse body and coarse mind are shutting down. So in those first four stages, the me that's undergoing the process is still the me labelled on the mind and body, this body, because it's still active. But at the end of those four stages, the coarse body has shut down, coarse mind shut down. Then, over the next three stages, we have the subtle body, subtle mind shutting down. So the me that's undergoing that experience is a me labelled on the subtle body, subtle mind. So of course this me here is no longer human, but it is a being, a sentient being, labelled on the subtle body, subtle mind. Then at the last stage of the death process, the subtle body is shut down. We end up with the very subtle body and the very subtle mind. Very subtle body, of course, the very subtle wind energy, and the very subtle mind of clear light. So the me at that time is labelled depending on the very subtle mind, very subtle body. Then we exit this life, we go into the bardo, in the intermediate period, where we take on a subtle mind and a subtle body. So we have a bardo being, a me, labelled on subtle body, subtle mind. Then that connects with the fertilized egg in the womb. So again, we have the coarse body and the beginnings of the coarse mind. And a new life begins. So the me there, again, is human and is labelled on the basis of the mind and body existing at that point. So what we can see at every stage here, the me that exists
The dependent me is the me labelled on the basis of the body and mind that is active. So, therefore, we talk about the mere I. So, generally, in this Madhyamika philosophical system, when the question is, what goes from life to life? The answer is, the mere I. But personally, even saying that, I find a bit awkward, because the question is, what goes from life to life? If you say mere I, then people grasp onto this mere I, oh, that's the thing that jumps from this life to the next. That's not the case.
What holds everything together?
Holds everything together. Causes and conditions. So at the physical level, causes and conditions. At the mental level, causes and conditions. Conservation of mass energy, conservation of consciousness. Nothing more than that.
Same.
Any questions about this? Yeah.
You talked about melting of the very subtle body with some energy in the heart center.
Yeah, the very subtle wind energy.
Ah, this is the very subtle wind. Okay.
Yeah, so often that's called the indestructible drop.
Yeah.
The very subtle mind and very subtle wind energy are always together. And they're only active at the point of death.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, they're dormant. And then after that, they're dormant. Because then the subtle body mind becomes active, and then the coarse body and mind are active.
I still feel like I'm missing something here. Sorry. All of it. But if the me or the mere I is the root of our suffering.
No.
No.
No, 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 no. The mere I is how we exist.
Okay.
We are a dependent me.
Yeah.
Now we grasp on to independent me. So the root of suffering is grasping on to independent me.
Okay.
Realizing emptiness is realizing there's no independent me. The flip side of realizing emptiness is that we realize this is how we exist, actually exist, as something merely labeled on the body and the mind.
I wonder if you can relate to this. There's like a theory that I don't know if resembles to me in my mind. It's the dependent me is basically just is based or dependent on the experiences that the body and the mind have experienced. And then each moment I die and
a new me is born.
And the dependent me is rebirth again by the experiences of the body and the mind.
Yeah, we can say that in every moment a new me is born. Nothing wrong with that, because in every moment the body's different, the mind's different. So in every moment a new me is born. Nothing wrong with saying that. That's fine.
And the dependent me is basically dependent on the experiences that each person has, and it's a story that each person tells himself by the experiences that.
And remember, that's exactly the point. The me depends on those.
Yeah.
The me is not those things.
It depends on the experiences, and that therefore the dependent me is just a story each person tells himself. But maybe that's
story. We're not a story.
We
have stories. The thing is to feel comfortable, we want to be able to hold on to something. That's me. Yeah?
Okay.
Don't we? We're always looking for, oh yeah, that's the real me. I want to hold on to that. That's me. That's the whole problem, is that holding on is grasping. We're trying to find something that is me.
No, but if you do it with the realization that it's changing all the time, it's not. It's dependent on the experiences that you have. Therefore, you die every moment, and then you are reborn.
Yeah. So what we need to appreciate is that the me is not findable at all. Because findable means independent. So the me is just something labelled on the body and the mind, labelled on our experiences, labelled on our memories, our habits, Everything we can use. For example, we're not saying that in every moment we always label me on the entire body and mind. We don't. You know, when we're thinking, we say, I am thinking based on mental content. When we have some problem in the body, we say, oh, I'm hurt. Then we're labelling me on the basis of some part of the body. So we're not labelling me on everything in every moment. But the me is always labelled on the basis of some aspect of body and mind. And actually, this is a point I want to add in here that can be helpful, is, and that's particularly the case now that you're starting with Renato with this observing the mind, and then actually in a day or two we're going to do this resting in awareness. In those experiences, it's very common also to have fear. And that's also a very good sign. Because now our sense of me is constantly being reinforced, most often by this. We have a solid sense of body, me, me, me. And then also a sense of me is constantly being reinforced by mental activity, thoughts, memories, stories, emotions. That's constantly reinforcing our sense of me at the physical and mental level. So we feel, okay, yeah, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. What happens in meditation, of course, we sit down, relax, body relaxes, sometimes even to the point we have no sense of body. So that reinforcing sense of me, gone. And then in this practice you're doing, starting with Renata, now observing the mind, often there's blah, 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 lots of stuff, but then sometimes it goes quiet. And then all of a sudden there's no mental activity reinforcing a sense of me. No solid body, no mental activity. Ah, I'm going out of existence. Fear. Ah. So again, this is very healthy,
yeah,
to understand that this, that what's going on here is there's nothing reinforcing a false sense of me. And if we have that very spacious experience, rather than fear, we just rest in that experience. And so this can be also very helpful in appreciating we're not the body, we're not the mind, we're not our thoughts, we're none of these things. Because we can have no thoughts, no sense of body, and still be present. So we're none of those things.
About the four steps.
Yeah.
You said maybe what question I need to ask myself and how maybe I need to feel and then ask. How can I avoid? Because probably I will feel in fear and then maybe I will cry and.
Yes. Okay.
Because you said that.
Sure, sure. So again, what's very helpful is, one thing that's helpful is to listen, reflect about the idea of emptiness dependent arising, to come to appreciate there is a me and it's a dependent me. The more we can appreciate that, then in that experience, in the not finding, rather than fear, will have joy, because it will reinforce our understanding there's a dependent me instead of independent me. So this is one thing we can do, is continue to deepen our understanding of how we really do exist, to help us with that. And then, of course, if some fear is coming up, then we ask, we say, who's having the fear? Who's having the fear? There's a me here. Sure, sure. So therefore, what we need to do when we do this search, if you actually find something you believe this is me, you look at that clearly and really look closely and see, is that really the me? And keep looking at that. And not to just automatically go through this and go, oh, no, no, I'm not findable, not findable, not findable. This is not helping anyone. So again, we're convinced there's an independent me, so we need to look for that. And if you really do find something in the body and the mind which you believe is me, you really look at that very closely. And if whatever you find, if that's me, One thing you can do, if it's me, it must have all the qualities and attributes of me. Because it's me. And then you can go, I am so tall. Is this thing that tall? I am blah, blah, blah. Does this have these qualities? And really look closely, is that me? And particularly, I don't know if Renato is going to bring this in, but the idea at the beginning, we start by thinking about maybe someone's praising us or criticizing us, and we have this sense of me. If we find something, we can go, is that the me that's being criticized? Is that the me that's being praised? We can ask these sorts of questions. And we really have to do this very thoroughly. Otherwise, it just becomes mechanical, and we go, I'm not findable. And then nothing happens. Yeah, then you look at what you find more and more closely, and you investigate that, and you keep investigating.
Could you say that maybe trying to go back to infancy, when you're just born and you exist, but you don't differentiate between yourself and your mother or your bottle, or not the same?
This, I read this once, I think, in philosophy. It's called the pre-trans fallacy. What it means is that, you know, and some traditions talk about going back to the childlike me. But this is what's called the pre-trans fallacy, meaning that it's not that the baby realizes anything, it's just they have not developed the ability to accurately distinguish themselves from others. It's not like they're realizing oneness. Yeah, but they have no realization of oneness. It's just that they haven't developed the capability of correctly distinguishing themselves from others. We have to go through that to transcend the false view. We go back to that, we're pre-fallacy. It's not helpful.
You already spoke about the conservation of mass and energy.
Mm-hmm.
So here, on that mind, we have the conservation of energy, right?
Because consciousness, not energy. Mind's not energy.
Okay, so whatever is going to ascend to the other life is conserved, right?
Correct. So we have here a continuum of mind.
So that is the new, no?
Why?
I mean, it's a changeable, transcending.
You have same at the physical level. We have a continuum of physical change. Same.
But the body would change, but the mind.
The mind's changing. We have subtle, very subtle mind, very different to coarse mind.
So
just like subtle body, very different to coarse body. But there's always a continuum of change in both levels.
So it's only the subtle mind that remains?
At this point, it's only the very subtle mind that's active, yes.
Okay. Which, and then goes into the next life.
And then it becomes dormant, and then we have the subtle mind and the coarse mind.
Okay, so the subtle mind transcends to the other life.
Transcends, but the subtle mind is not a thing that moves through time. It's part of the continuum.
Because I'm trying to understand how could people remember then their past lives? There must be
There's a continuum, constant continuum here, that memories are associated with.
And we cannot associate with that.
It's like a simple level, like... In our day, you know, during the day, our waking mind is active. The mind of dreaming and deep sleep is dormant. You go to sleep, the dreaming mind becomes active, the waking mind is dormant. And then you go to deep sleep, the dreaming mind's dormant, the waking mind's dormant. And so we go through this cycle, but all along, there's just a continuum of mind. So similarly here, in our life, the coarse mind is active. Then it goes dormant, we have the subtle mind active, then it goes dormant, we have the very subtle mind active, and then we go through the same sort of cycle as waking, dreaming, sleeping in the birth, death, rebirth process. So, but there's always a continuum. In the continuum, there's a different level active, just like in a daily life, a different level of mind is active. When we go to sleep, the level of our mind is active is much more subtle. And then when we dream, a little bit more coarse, waking more coarse. So we have this, but there's always continuum.
So it would be wrong if I associate myself with this mind that stays through continuum?
Well, now your very subtle mind is not active.
Yeah.
So the you that exists now is labeled only on your coarse mind. The basis for you now is not the very subtle mind, it's the coarse mind. Because that's what exists now.
But if I was a tantric practitioner and I awaken my subtle mind...
Yes, then you would at that point, if you're in meditation, the tantric meditator is now, the one that's meditating is one labelled on the very subtle mind because that's attractive at that point. Yes. Yes.
I think I totally didn't get the merely labelled I. So I...
Okay. Don't. What bit didn't you get? Everything.
Okay.
Let's try very simple again. Very simple. Pen is not the collection of the parts. That's okay?
Yeah.
The pen is something labeled depending on those parts. Does that go so far? The me, the person, is not the parts, the body and the mind. Me merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. Like the pen is merely labelled on the parts. Me is merely labelled on the body and mind. Same? Okay? No. Okay. Pen is not the parts, collection of parts.
I'm not sure if it's also this terminology, merely labelled, perhaps?
Well, the pen is merely labelled on the parts. Let's forget merely. The pen is labelled depending on the parts. That's okay so far? You're labelling pen on the parts.
Yes.
You're labelling me on the body and mind. Yeah. That's it. That's the me that exists. The me that's labelled on the body and mind. That's the me you're on. Isn't it? Can you find a pen there?
No.
Can you find a me here? Isn't pen something we're labelling on these parts?
Yes.
Isn't me something we're labelling on the body and the mind?
Yes.
That's it. Nothing more than that. That's it.
So you are your continuum.
No, that's saying that the pen is the parts.
No,
you have a continuum. You have a continuum. maybe someone who hasn't asked many questions.
Is it true to say that I am conscience, thus a body that is dependent on emotions, memories, thoughts?
Again, we have a body and a mind.
But something experiences.
Yeah, me.
Feels
the person.
So.
And that experience takes place in the mind. Yes. That's okay.
Okay. So the mind is like a container or a vessel of...
Often we talk about the body as the vessel for the mind, but you could say the mind is the vessel for thoughts and emotions and experiences. Yes, you can say that.
So this I exists, it just changes all the time?
Of course. Changing all the time, like everything else. Everything's changing all the time. Last question.
I think I get the concept of dependent me. Well, at least intellectually, not actually. I guess the question I have is more about dependence generally. And I think
sure.
This is what I wasn't
sure.
Necessarily getting earlier. But
sure.
So in the middle way, there is a physical world, it's just not independent.
Correct.
And the implication of that is that if tomorrow, like all things capable of perceiving, all humans and animals were wiped out by a plague, then what we call the physical world would cease to exist. But there would be nothing that remains of that. Which is to say, everything remains of that.
Again, even sort of saying it that way, I get the sense you're still having a perspective of matter primary. So it's difficult to answer that question based on the way you've asked it. Because it seems to me that it's like, you know, that tree in the forest, if no one's there to watch or to hear it, does it make a sound? Asking like that, I can't answer the question because it seems to me the way the question's asked is presupposing. It has an assumption built in to the question.
Anyway, so let's leave it there. We've run out of time. Tomorrow, so now we've gone through the Four Noble Truths, and on that basis we looked at the Mahayana, we looked at the bodhicitta, we looked at the emptiness, the wisdom compassion practices, and we briefly looked at Tantra Vajrayana as the highest level of practice. What I'd like to do tomorrow then is look at how the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism packages all of this. Because we now have got all sorts of practices, all sorts of things, and then we go, well, okay, where do I start? What's first? And then how do I do it step by step? So, of course, every Buddhist tradition has a framework, has a sort of a system. And so what we're going to look at tomorrow is the Geluk system, the Geluk approach, and the system of practice is called Lam Rim, Stages of the Path to Enlightenment. And so reading for that, we will be covering page 10, 11, and then of course we got bodhicitta and emptiness that we've covered, but that's also part of it, 12, 13, and also 14. So that's sort of the a lot of the things we've covered, but particularly page 10 and 11 would be very helpful to look at if you've already looked at bodhicitta and emptiness. And then also what I'd like to do tomorrow afternoon is that now we've talked, remember, in all Buddhist traditions, three core practices: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So we've looked at ethics, we've looked now at wisdom or vipassana in some detail. I want to now look a little bit more about the concentration practice, the shamatha practice. And so we're going to be looking at that using this chart and description here. So that's going to be tomorrow afternoon. Page 24, 25 is the topic for tomorrow afternoon. So now let's take a break. After the break, you'll be doing a little emptiness practice with Renato. And then this evening, the flip side of that, you'll be doing a little bit of dependent arising, looking at dependency this evening. So that's the two meditations for this evening. So let's have a break.